that's one of my old favorites, the Soweto String Quartet with Imbube. As you know them, the song is Wimowe. We know this song from a long time ago, those of us who remember the 60s. It's from their 1996 album, Renaissance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. This is the growing community of non-herd mentality thinkers who gather weekly at this particular and popular meeting place to trade in information, opinions, and ideas. And on Free Your Mind, your views are the star of the show. So call 888-874-4888 and let's hear what you think matters that affects the rest of us. 888-874-4888. Ma'at from New York, you get to start the program today.
Yes, good afternoon to the family, the beloved family, and you're so smart. That's another thing we love about
you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Same to you. What is up for consideration today?
Well, I want to bring up the situation from 4 years ago that has some recent news around it, and that is Romali Graham. Preet Bharara, and we need to put a call out to all you citizen journalists out there, bloggers, opinion makers, what have you, because it seems, and yesterday I heard a Constance Malcolm, the mother of Romali, on a couple of radio reports, and it seems that the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't see any basis, comes up with this mantra, oh, the standard is so high, there's no evidence. Now, this is Richard Hayes with two other officers in complicity that breaks into his home. And then comes up with, and this seems still to stand in 2016, that this officer, Richard Hayes, was afraid for his life. Well, he should have been afraid for your life when you break into somebody's home without warrant or legal basis. I mean, you know, you've done something that's off the chart, and yet that's what they're coming up with. I mean, it's like... And Ms. Malcolm, she's quite articulate, where she was saying that basically what they do at the academy is they train you to get away with murder. Now, one of my concerns is what a horrible precedent, and this Bharara needs to have full account. We need to know where he went to school, where he's from, and you need to see if they have someone, because they came out with a press release around this abomination, if someone from their office would come on air with you, Latrice, and give some understanding.
We're dealing with this on Monday, actually, this particular case, because it has precedence. This was a remarkably insane development, because Romali Graham apparently had gone to a bodega, a neighborhood store, not far from where he lived in the Bronx. And the store, as it turned out, was under surveillance by these undercover officers. He leaves the store, and he proceeds on his way home, and then is intercepted by police officers and literally runs home. He runs back to where he lived. The officers follow him, chase him, and Officer Haste chases him into his home and up the stairs
and breaks in.
Into
it
the
wasn't
bathroom.
He actually kicks the door down. Yeah.
He finds Romali Graham, a young man in his teens, hiding in the bathroom, and there he shoots him to death. And the you were correct, the federal prosecutor, Preet Bharara, the U.S. prosecutor in the Eastern District, I believe, or is it the Southern District, has decided that there's no reason, they find no reason to pursue an indictment, a criminal indictment of Officer Haste, because as we've heard this phrase before, the standard is so high, and because at the time of the killing, there were only two people in the bathroom, Officer Haste, who killed Ramali, and Ramali, who was killed by Officer Haste. And it is Preet Bharara's position, that is to say an extension of the Justice Department, saying that the standard of proof is very high, and there is such doubt that there would even be an indictment that the case is not going to be pursued. It is now officially shut down. So we'll be dealing with that on Monday.
Excellent. But let me just say that these stories that come down, now I heard Ms. Malcolm, his mother, say that Ramali was not in the bathroom. I heard his dad say, and I also heard her say that he wasn't running back home. And there's video of his just walking at a normal pace, and the video of the officers totally violating civil rights when they break down the door and barge in. So all of that needs to be straightened out. But the grandmother was also told to shut up, shut up, you know, with a lot of curse words. And the female officer, or she would be shot by the Haste officer. And these words are just so wrong to call these people officers of any kind. And the woman police officer actually threw her down on the floor, the grandmother. So it doesn't make any sense, because it says to us that if a police officer decides to break into your apartment or your home, your house, and can come up with they feel like they're in danger and shoot you, he was shot in the heart, this is something that's beyond outrageous. It's beyond outrageous. You know, and let me just conclude by saying that the FBI, and people need to look at the civil rights laws, Title 18, 241, 242. We need to know what laws that they're looking at. Do they need to create new laws? Not really. There are laws on the books that are more than sufficient, but it says to us, we're back in the Dred Scott days. Black people have no rights that white folks are bound to respect. Now, his name also suggests that he comes from maybe India or Pakistan or somewhere where it's mostly people of color. So it's just some of these people cannot too fast enough dip in and be engrossed in the white supremacy. And lastly, the FBI, curiously enough, and I never hear anybody talk about this, is the agency that's supposed to investigate on the civil rights laws. Now, isn't that a ha-ha, COINTELPRO fame and on, they shot the guy that was a friend of the alleged, probably patsies, in the Boston bombing. That's a whole nother story, where the Boston Globe said that there was to be a controlled bombing that day, which everybody forgets about. So I take nothing at face value. And I agree with Gene, this is a society that's headed toward imminent collapse, as illustrated by the recent incident with Donald Trump's back as one of his patrons socking a brother who was, and then the brother didn't even come back on him, and now luckily he's being held for assault, and he just very blightly said, "Oh, next time we'll kill him." So that's what I have to say this afternoon.
All right, well,
greetings and love to the
family. You got to start it today, Matt. Thank you for your call, Joel. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Nutrice. I hope you're well.
Yes, I'm trying to be. Thank
very
you so
good,
much.
Very good.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm going with the winds, as they say, trying to deal with all the stuff that's going on, like everybody else. You know what? I think last week or in a previous call before that I felt remiss in not really talking about the economy. And I really don't think that the economy is being discussed at all in the campaign, even though candidate Sanders spent a lot of time, talking about the need to revive the economy. But there has been very little discussion about why things are the way they are right now. What are the dynamics of all of this? So what I'd like to do is really talk about why the stock market is going so crazy right now. And the metaphor that I would give is, imagine if you went to the corner grocery store and found that all the items that you typically buy had doubled in price overnight. And that's essentially what's happened to stocks in the last 7 years. The Fed dropped the short-term interest rates, as most people know, to zero in 2009, and they kept them at rock bottom until last December. And the effect of that rate suppression, along with the Fed's aggressive liquidity injection program, which they call quantitative easing, sent stock prices into the stratosphere while the real economy remained mired, as it still is, in a long-term slump. So why did stock prices surge while the economy stayed flat on its back? And it all has to do with the way money enters the economy. As everybody knows, the Fed creates money, and if the Fed just creates reserves at the banks and holds down rates, that still doesn't get money into the pockets of ordinary people who spend it and rev up the economy. So for rates to have an impact on growth, people have to be willing to borrow money from banks and spend it on goods and services. And when lots of people take out loans and use it, you know, on projects or for the purchase of items, that's called a credit expansion. And when credit expands, money changes hands fast and the economy grows. So it all goes back to spending. If there's no spending, there's no growth, there are no jobs, no capital investment, and no virtuous cycle, which is what the economists call that. And the Fed knows all this. But for 7 years, they've watched as the monetary base has ballooned to madness proportions, as we all know, while loans and bank credit have barely budged. The Fed also knows why households aren't borrowing, because many households are still trying to reduce their debts. Businesses, on the other hand, aren't taking out loans because retail sales and personal consumption are still much weaker than they were before the Great Recession. The point is, the Fed knows that credit, that is, getting money circulating in the economy, isn't working, and they've known it for the better part of 6 years. So what are they up to? Why has the Fed dumped cash onto financial markets when there's no chance that the policy will strengthen growth? And the obvious explanation is that the Fed has a clear bias towards Wall Street. And what many people don't know is that the Fed's policies require the collaboration of Congress and the President to succeed. That is, if you, to transfer a greater portion of the nation's wealth to the 1% elites. And it works very, very simply. The politicians keep a lid on public spending to ensure that the economy doesn't get ahead of steam. That would increase hiring, boost wages, and push up inflation. That's the goal, keep inflation low so the Fed can continue to pump cheap money into the financial markets as it has been doing for a decade. And, you know, most people may have noticed that the steps Obama has taken to put a damper on growth have really significantly hurt the public sector. And since the recession, 500,000 public sector workers have lost their jobs. And many of those people, by the way, were African-Americans who moved into the public sector during the New Deal when Roosevelt opened up many federal jobs to black workers. And according to economists like Joe Stiglitz, if the economy had experienced a normal expansion, there would have been 2 million more public jobs. Instead, we've had the reverse. 500,000 have been removed. So just think about how much faster the economy would be growing if Obama had made some attempt to rehire the people who had lost their jobs in the crash. But Obama's not interested in lowering employment anymore than he's interested in strengthening growth. He's a creature of Wall Street, just like the Fed. That's
but
why
he's
we
also
have
a creature of the Clintons. Every person handling the financial affairs of the United States at this moment, mostly they have ties to the Clintons, or used to work
but
in
the
Clinton administration.
Yes, that's absolutely true, but the Clintons are also the creature of the Fed. I mean, I strongly believe that that there's a power elite in this country and that politicians, you know, serve their interests. And once the Clintons understood where power rests, then they acted accordingly.
So based on what you outlined so far, Joel, what therefore is the logical action that should be taken by regular people like you and me?
Well, I'm writing a piece about this now. I'm in the middle of writing a little piece, and I'm going to send it to you. But it certainly, if in fact, if I can just get back to it, maybe I can answer it circuitously and then get off. If I think another way of asking that question is why, I think first we have to ask, why has Obama been so focused on slashing the budget deficits when the economy is barely growing? I mean, we learn in high school that that when private sector spending is weak, when government government spending must increase to keep the economy from collapsing. Instead, Obama has trimmed a full $1 trillion from deficits since Bush left office. Why would he do that? Increasing deficits provides, after all, the vital fiscal stimulus to keep the economy growing. But Obama doesn't want store growth because that would push up inflation and force the Fed to raise rates, which would cut the flow of cheap money to Wall Street. That's what's really driving this austerity fetish, the demand for cheap cash to the investor class. And there's a good chance now that, you know, as the shadow economy crashes, that the chaos in the markets will spill over into the real economy in the form of more corporate defaults, which we're seeing now, higher unemployment, which I think is going to rise once the service economy is impacted, because there is no industrial economy anymore, and deepening deflation. And that means that ordinary people like you and me will suffer from the excesses in the financial markets. It's not going to happen through traditional political action, because the politicians are wed to Wall Street. It's not enough for Bernie Sanders to say that I'm going to cut, go after the investment class and make sure that the five large investment banks are capped at a capital investment of $50 billion. Well, that's a lot less than the $1 trillion that they're set at now, but it's still not putting them at what you've got to do is nationalize the banks. And that's not going to happen unless you have a people's movement, because we all know, and we've been talking about this, you know, for years on your program and on other programs as well, that the Congress is bought and paid for. It provides these essential services for the investor class and for the Fed, which reflects the investor class. And Obama knows this, and the Clintons knew this. That's why the Clintons have gotten $161 million from Wall Street in the past since 1992. So it's only going to happen if we have a popular movement, if we have really a kind of spontaneous but really rationally perceived social movement that's based on a coalition of all these radical groups that are out there, from environmental groups to old age groups to groups of young African Americans who are now mobilizing in city after city, to students who understand that they're in debt for life. I mean, there are so many groups out there, and what we need to do now is to create a popular front like they had in the 1930s, and with that popular front comes a raising of consciousness. We have to recognize that traditional politics will not get us anywhere.
Was making the point all week and last week too that it is a duty, as I see it, it is a duty of Bernie Sanders, while he runs, to also serve as the lightning rod for a parallel movement, which is the movement that you're describing, bringing together all these disparate groups under a common purpose, and to begin the formation of an independent political structure that could sustain candidacies at every single level throughout the country. That's the job I see that he has. I know it's running for president is a full-time thing, but in the end, in as much as he's calling for a revolution, the true revolution is not reforming this cruddy system. The true revolution is putting something else in its place.
Right.
And that's what he's got to do. That's what I think he should do. Demand should be that there ought to be a parallel purpose for his candidacy, and it can't just be I'm running for president and come, you know, the end of the year, that's over and done with, and then he crawls back and into his regular life. No, there should be a demand made here.
Sure, but that's what's going to happen. After all, he's made a Faustian party with the Democratic Party, and he made it many, many years ago. And that deal was that he would always campaign for national Democrats. He campaigned for Clinton.
in 92. He campaigned for him again in 96. He campaigned for Kerry in 2004, et cetera, et cetera. His deal that he has made with the Democratic Party is that he will support their national candidates, and they will run weak candidates against him. And so he's, you know, he's made his bed. And if he breaks that deal, he'll lose his committee chairmanships. He'll lose his seniority in the Senate. And that would mean that he would have to break from the Democratic caucus, and he won't do that. So,
well, this is why I'm saying he has to be confronted with it, and he has to be compelled to answer that question.
Well, you know, I think
is he going to do it or not? And have him actually verbalize the answer.
Right.
Not leave it up to conjecture, but to have him commit one way or the other. You either are with this, this idea that you're professing of a truly a grassroots revolution, if you will, or you're not. Not piecemeal, not accommodation, not capitulating to the Democratic Party. The idea is that the Democratic Party has ceased to be useful and relevant and beneficial to the vast majority of people who continue to support it. Thanks, Joel, for your call today.
Okay,
but
you
could finish up. Go ahead. Are you there? Okay, Joel is gone. Well, I want to thank you for that. It's an extraordinary piece that you delivered today. New York, Philip, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air, Philip.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Utrecht.
Thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. It's I'm a listener, and I've called, I believe, once before. And just my luck, I come on after Joel, and he's said so many things I've taken notes on, my head spinning. So hopefully, when he presents the information to you, maybe we'll be able to get a look at what it is Joel's talking about. There's one thing that I would say in reference to Joel's commentary. I've never considered President Obama to be in charge. I believe that we live in a system dedicated to injustice in terms of how non-white people fit in. So he may be president, but he's not the final and the ultimate decision maker. I've come to that realization, and but that's a whole other thing. That's not what I called about today. Utrecht, I was talking with a group of young people a few days ago, and I'm sort of up in arms because constitutionally, we're supposed to be a land of laws, a country of laws, and all that good stuff. We hear that all the time. And just a few weeks ago, I saw a report out of I believe it's California, where a group of Klan supporters showed up at a rally. I think it might have been an anti-police brutality rally, and all hell broke loose. And you know, some of the members of the Klan were beaten, and some of the protesters who were originally there were assaulted and stabbed by the Klan members. Now, I mention that because the following day we discovered that some of the members of the Klan who'd been arrested were released from prison or from jail, and the protesters, on the other hand, were being those who were found were still incarcerated, and those who had not been found were being searched for. That sort of struck me as unusual because the Klan showed up at that rally believing they had a First Amendment right to intimidate, aggravate, and frustrate the people that were there. Well, when I took a look at what's happening at the Donald Trump rallies, I'm looking at an inverse situation here because you operate with the belief that free speech is a part and parcel of what we believe in this country, at least what we're told applies in this country. And those who show up at a Donald Trump rally have, I would assume, the same rights that the Klan has to, you know, the First Amendment right to free speech, even if you sit there with a sign and keep your mouth shut. But what we're seeing is a gentleman, I shouldn't call him that, but I'm not going to get into disparaging comments. We have a contestant or an individual running to be the president of the United States of America who has already, before he even gets through the nominating process, determined that the First Amendment doesn't apply to everyone in the country. And so he'll say from the stage, beat him up, punch him. If it were me, I'd punch him in the face. And I don't think he's tuned in to understand what it means to be the president of the United States, that you support and you honor and you maintain the Constitution. So I think that we're looking at an issue that constitutionally may represent some problems as we move forward. I don't know how many Mike Tysons there are out there supporting Donald Trump, but I'm amazed that those who do take that position either are ignorant of or don't care that he does not use his voice, his influence, or his status to protect anyone. I haven't forgotten what he did back in the Central Park jogger case. I've never forgotten that. I've always held that against him. I recently read an article that Alton Maddox wrote where he says that he was the Black Knight, in this term, Black Knight being the positive fighter, against the White Knight, Donald Trump, and how he stood him down some years ago. But it's a big,
you should mention that in the case of the Central Park young men who were falsely arrested and railroaded into prison for many years for the alleged sexual attack, rape of a woman, a white woman who was jogging through Central Park, and she was beaten within a hair of her life, he called for the death penalty. And
yes.
Even basically, don't even bother with the trial. Just kill them. Kill them all. But, you know, I want to kind of ask you a question here based on your premise about these constitutional rights, specifically as they pertain to free speech. I've said on this program, there are no rights that anybody has that are absolute, and certainly not of people of color who are part of the oppressed of this country. No rights at all that you can say are guaranteed. And the interesting thing here is that this particular incident illustrates the point perfectly. You have the assumption, on one hand, of natural law prevailing, and that is as it applies to Donald Trump, and even the white man who attacked the black man in behalf of Donald Trump, okay?
Yes.
The presumption was clear. They are of a class where those actions, even as horrible as they are, could be covered under their natural law that they have freedom of speech. The black man who was attacked, he has no rights at all. Dred Scott decision announced that and made
right.
it clear. But beyond that, he has what many people should understand, and that is he has permitted rights. He has no guarantee of rights at all, not in this country. You have permitted speech when you're black, and permitted speech, you always have to file some kind of paperwork. Can I please protest on such and such a day? And they tell you how many feet on the sidewalk you're allowed to occupy and when you could protest and how loud your megaphone ought to be and how many people should assemble. You have permitted speech. There are no rights, none, not even the right to life itself. I've said it many times here on this program.
Yes.
Are absolute when it comes to people of color. None. All rights are completely negotiable.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I look at this, and here again, you don't really hear this sort of commentary that I just heard from you anywhere else. It's really difficult to hear anyone speak truth to power. But that's one of the reasons that I listen, one of the reasons that I tune in, Utrice. And I appreciate your taking my call. I think that, for me, I just wanted to highlight that. And I'm thinking now that I believe it is Jose that refers you as professor. And I approve and I appreciate your professorial input.
I thank you so much for calling in. What a refreshing point of view that you introduced for our consideration today, and I thank you for contributing to our discussion. Thank you so much. Well, Jose was mentioned, and here he is. Jose, you're on the air.
Ancestral blessings be upon you, my professor.
Thank you, Jose. How are you?
Well, the elder is here, and I'm trying hard to free up my mind. And whenever I speak to you, believe me, I get some freedom.
Well, thank
now,
you for that.
Now, I have a lot on my plate, but first I would like to make a quote to our people that Mr. Garvey gave to us in 1924. Mr. Garvey says, and I quote, "If you are strong, you have justice on your side." He said, "If you are weak, you are at the mercy of the dispenser of justice. He said, there is no justice but strength. There is no justice but power. If you have sense and want justice, get power. Get it quick. Get it anyhow. Unquote. And Brother Malcolm would say, by any means necessary. My professor, I was listening to one of your callers talked about the Romari Graham case.
That's Mott.
Good. And I must say to you, when Romari Graham was shot, when he was murdered, I attended a town hall meeting in the Bronx. It was put together by the community board, and they invited the police department, and the police commissioner was supposed to have been there, but he chose not to attend because he didn't see where, you know, where are people that he need to show himself there. We have no importance. And the police commander, he made a statement at that meeting. He said that they have had great relationships with the community board and the community and so forth, but it is the outsiders who come into the community to create problems. And that was when I got up because I saw red. And I said to him, I said, how dare you refer to black folks who come here on behalf of their people as outsiders? I said, whenever African people has a problem with injustice in this country, any part of this country or this world, we as African people have a right to be there. Whether you were born in this country 10 or 20 generations back, whether you came here a few years ago or you got here today, I say we have a right as African people to stand up for the cause of African people. I say, how dare you? I say, you need to find out where these police officers in the precinct, your precinct under your command, where do they live? Where do they come from? I said, they are the outsiders. How dare you call us outsiders? I said, we are here on behalf of our people's interests. What are those people? Those people that live upstate and out of state and so forth. They are the outsiders. And my queen, my professor, this is an exercise in futility. For decades, I have seen African people murdered before our very eyes. And we have these exercises in futility, and it goes on and on and on. Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder can see the grave injustice, the out-and-out murder that just coming in front of our eyes. And we still are discussing these issues, and it simply means that we are here as a people, and we have no rights that white folks ever intend to respect. And let me move right along, my professor. I told you I have a few things on the plate.
But we have a long line today, as it turns out, Jose. So
I'm
going to
be quick, real quick, my professor. I was listening to, I remember.
Are you there?
I was listening to a scheme that the St. Kitts and Nevis has come up with, where they are giving citizenship. There, a reporter was there in St. Kitts, and they show these beautiful homes and so forth. That all a foreigner has to do, the Russians and the Chinese and so forth, they have to just buy this house, and they get a passport and all kind of legal documents as a St. Kitts and Nevis citizen. And it's only because two of them who got the passport went to Canada. And it came under scrutiny because the Canadian government recognized them as international criminals. And lastly, my queen, my professor, queen and professor, there is we just had an election recently in Jamaica. And it is now a bit of a conundrum because it was so close. And one of the issues that came up was about the leader of the opposition, who's now the prime minister, about a home that he was building. If you look at the area's view of the Hearst Castle, the house that this man has built, and he was only a leader, a prime minister for a brief moment, and he has this house, if you look at it from aerially, it looks like the Hearst Castle, and it came under scrutiny. And he had the nerve to tell the people that it's because the people are envious and grudgeful and bad-minded. They don't want to see him prosper and have a house. And everybody in the country can have a house. And he supports that and all kind of foolishness. And I'm trying to tell them that every politician who takes office on behalf of the people, they have a right to go through all kind of scrutiny. Any one of them, from the prime minister to anyone, the opposition, they must go through a scrutiny. If you want to go into politics, your life must be open up because you claim you're going in there to serve the people. And they have these stupid people believing that they don't have the right to question these rascals when they plunder and rob the resources of the country. That's why you go all over the world on all this leadership of all this money that they rob and plunder from the people, these foreign banks and so forth. And the United States and the other colonial powers know where these rascals have this money. And if they want to stop them from doing it, they can stop them. But they are colluded with these criminals to do the criminal acts that they are doing. So I'm sorry we didn't have more time, but they have so much more to say. But I'll just get off now and let you talk to the other call. But I hope you get this issue out there on your program one day. We have to talk about these criminals that are robbing and plundering the coffers of these small countries and helping them to go under. We need to expose them, my professor.
Thank you very much, Jose, for your call and for your contribution today. Always something to learn. Thank you so much. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Therese, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. As you know, this weekend is the center capital of Chicago is becoming the center capital of election circus. Donald Trump is here in Chicago. So is Bernie Sanders. Hillary, I think, was here yesterday. But the Illinois primary is on Tuesday, so this is the reason why they are all here, since, you know, a large block of voters are in Chicago for Illinois. But I wanted to bring this up because you made a good point about the quote-unquote freedom of speech and who has the right, who doesn't have the right, and whose limits, whose rights can be tested to the limit, because this basically ties into Donald Trump's appearance here, because there's a group of protesters here in Chicago who are planning to protest the event. And actually, there are a group of protesters, because the event is free, that will actually be inside the venue. He's going to be at the UIC Pavilion here in Chicago. So I'm interested to see what happens in that event, you know, considering what happened to the black man who got punched by a white supremacist at, you know, Donald Trump's previous event. But, you know, it's an interesting thing because there was a lot of bubbling amongst the grassroots community about, you know, protesting this event, this Donald Trump event. But I also wanted to talk about this because I remember you were talking about Bernie Sanders trying to start a movement even after this election. And I kind of parallel it to what Chuy Garcia had failed to do upon losing the Chicago mayoral election last year, because, you know, he had the opportunity to do the same thing, to start a campaign in the third party movement within, you know, the Chicago political system, you know, to counteract the Chicago Democrats, because I think he had a lot of grassroots support, you know, in the mayoral election last year. But unfortunately, he failed to do that. And I'm hoping, you know, Bernie doesn't fail to do that, although I kind of feel he's going to just, you know, go along with the Democratic machine nationally and just support Hillary once he loses. But Chuy was very much in that same position as well to start a movement here in Chicago. But he just, you know, he failed to do that, and I'm hoping Bernie doesn't make the same mistake.
Well, the signs are that he is going to go, just as you said, he would probably go, and he has indicated that he will be supporting the Democratic candidate who is nominated by the party. I mean, he has publicly pledged his troth to the Democratic Party, which is very sad, which is why I'm saying that we've got to have a public discussion of this, and he has to be nailed on this question as to where his allegiances are. This is how we continue to lose momentum, and this is how, in fact, I've said that Bernie Sanders, so far, is quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
He, I mean, from the establishment point of view, he is, quote, losing, unquote. And it may very well be the case that, you know, the way they define winning and losing is just a matter of who gets the most delegates. Okay, well, let's say he's putting up a good fight on that front. But the real prize is not necessarily just capturing of delegates. I think he needs to fight that. He's not indicating that he has a problem with it. Maybe he's waiting until the convention itself to raise this issue, the way Jesse Jackson did. But I understand he's meeting with Jackson today, ostensibly to have Jackson at least look kindly upon his candidacy and do for him, Bernie Sanders, this time around, what Sanders had done for Jackson twice in 1984 and in 1988, which was to endorse him.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that those talks occur. But we have, again, a reminder. I keep talking about it. This reminder and this parallel between Jackson and Bernie Sanders. We have a groundswell by any measure. You cannot ignore the fact that Bernie Sanders, as a come-from-behind kind of candidate, a clear underdog in this race, has racked up impressive showings and is creating momentum and is galvanizing people and introducing new people to the, you know, to bring to fruition what they envision as an alternative way to move. They're looking for some place to put their energy, and they see it in Bernie. Now, why it is that he is not talking the revolution that he said his candidacy is about? The revolution is really creating something else, a parallel structure, if only to maintain himself as a major force. And here is where Jackson, too, has an opportunity to make up for his treachery and his selling out of the 7 million votes that he got in 1984 and 1988.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Jackson, remember I kept saying, Jackson can serve if he had any integrity at all. And we know that's an arguable question. Jackson should be playing the role of grand statesman here with the capacity to do heavy damage to anybody who does not seem to pay attention to the needs of the people. He should be in that position today. Not as a guy who just endorses, but as a guy who makes or breaks candidacies. But he is so compromised. He's such a toady to the Democratic Party. And it would take so much for him to overcome his the sellout that he has consistently done, to even now say, okay, Bernie, if I have to choose between you and Hillary, all right, we're going to go with you. He's not going to do that. But if he does it, here is a crystal moment. And they keep wasting all these opportunities. Here is an extraordinary opportunity to regain that lost ground, to resituate and reposition himself and the constituencies that supported him in a different space, and to begin the process of reigniting this movement that he played a major role, not just in stalling, but in killing. He could show some degree of atonement here if he's so inclined. My suspicion, though, is that he will not be so inclined. I'll be pleasantly surprised if he changes course. But here's where we will see another wasted moment. And that means that I think, and by the way, Jesse Jackson not only would have been pivotal in the outcome in South Carolina, where he was born, but also in Chicago, where he lives. So this is a really important. These are historical things happening here, and we ought to be sensitive to it about the moment that we're witnessing, and potentially will be wasted if the candidates themselves don't act differently. Bernie Sanders has to be confronted, and he has to be asked a question. What do you intend to do with all of this support? Are you basically drawing all of this energy back into the Democratic Party? Is that what you're going to do? Are you going to tell these people who are out there working so hard to elect you that the best thing to do is to elect Hillary Clinton if you lose? Then forget you. We don't need to get excited about you. And you are not as committed as you say to this so-called revolution that you keep talking about. This is the time to ask the question and get an answer.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Henry, in your wonderful city, since by proxy, this is where the fight should be fought, not only because Chicago's mayor is a Clinton former chief of staff, but also because it is right across the river from Detroit.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sorry I was silent because I was just listening to you. But, I think Chewy missed that opportunity last year to form a third party. And it is not much more what he did. It's not what he's doing, because once he lost the election, it was like he just went into hiding and we never heard from him again, you know, up until now, where he's actually supporting Bernie Sanders in this election. I think Sanders is going to meet with Chewy today while he's here in Chicago. But yeah, and the thing about it was Chewy had a chance to win the election, whereas
he certainly
Bernie,
did have a chance to win. But here's a question, and I gotta ask you the question: is this Chewy's job? Is it only Chewy's job, or is it only Bernie Sanders' job?
Oh, no, it's definitely not, you know, just their job to do it. But like you said, I don't think enough people took Chewy to task on what he's going to do, you know, if he didn't win this election, you know. And I agree with you on that one. The people should have really took him to task on that, you know, point.
But the people also, since they are the ones generating the energy, they ought to also stake their ownership claim in it. They don't have to wait for somebody to do it. You have a movement that is there. That you have thousands and thousands of people ready to hear your message. You have people who are ready to do something. Do the work and form the parallel structure. Give them the alternative. Do the work now. And do it now, because this is the season where everybody's attention is heightened. They understand and they open to suggestions as to what other ways could be explored so that their needs are met. This is the time that messages should be sent. But we don't see the other third parties working aggressively here. And we don't see them offering healthy alternatives. But so this is the work the people themselves have to do. And I do say, in some cases in Detroit, I know, grassroots people are organizing. I know in Chicago, which is going to have a big showdown soon over its teachers, and the intention of the governor to impose a emergency management on the school system, that they will have no choice but to galvanize and their interests and work against the system. Why not do it now? Why not seize the moment and begin the process now?
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Thanks, Henry. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
All righty. Let's hear from Rick from Long Island.
Hello,
Rick. You're on the air.
Hey, yes. Actually, I am from, I've spoken to you before. I am from Ohio.
Oh, wow. Okay. Sorry.
So, okay. Now, so I'm hearing all of this about race and racism against blacks and all of that, right? This is what we're talking about today. Am I correct? Hello?
The idea is whatever you wish to talk about. This is an open forum.
All right, let me say this. This is something I get in this argument all the time. I get it everywhere I go. I understand that what many times it isn't race. It has nothing to do with race, even though it affects blacks directly, specifically, and uniquely. Let me say this real quick. I just lost a case in the Sixth Circuit here, or in Cincinnati, Ohio. That's where it is. And I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I was fired from a job that I claimed I couldn't do. And the EEOC contacted me before the investigation and said, hey, they said you signed up for this. And that the company is offering you $100,000 and said that they made a mistake. And I said that I'm not bound. I didn't accept the $100,000. And I sued. I started petitioning federal court here. And I sued for the agreement that I signed established only unproductive workers, which was a violation of my 13th Amendment right, involuntary servitude, and that they only used women and minorities to fulfill the position. But I also argued that it's not racist because there is no proof. You see, you can't, regardless of what you think, you can't splinter society because you think it. And so what you're doing is something else. It is diabolical, but you're simply using race as an excuse. And so I also sued the EEOC and the director because when they closed the case and gave me a 90-day right to sue, they changed my address to Las Vegas. And so they slowed down the entire process. I you know, everything expired. But it ended up in the Sixth Circuit. They took the case because I only asked for an investigation. I didn't ask for money. I didn't ask for anything because the EEOC said it wasn't a violation of Title VII, but the agreement is a direct violation of Title VII, a specific statute in Title VII involving race. And like I said, again, it has nothing to do with race. And so, for example, I've listened to Tim Wise and his 400 years of head start of whites over blacks and how much land was given to whites and all of this. And he says that's racist. And I say that's not, because what happened was the bank simply used whites as a conduit for looting resources. But whites think that they are organically on top, but there is no proof, because that's, and overall, I think this is why the planet melts, because nothing has ever been broken as proof that anything is true.
So all right. Well, I get where you're going, and basically you're raising a kind of a philosophical argument. But here's the
thing.
Here's the issue. The issue that you really are pointing to, I don't know that you can make a good case that in the situation that you just described, race is not a factor. It may not be a factor in your view as it applies to you and your particular case. But if you're talking about yourself as a member of a class, which is what you're not talking about, you see yourself as an individual, and this right there is the issue of race. Because you have the luxury of seeing yourself as an individual. And most other people who are of the oppressed classes understand themselves to be members of an oppressed class. You have two different points of view here. The question is that the rights and privileges that accrue to you are automatic because you are the beneficiary of natural law. The assumption that, as the Supreme Court had ruled, the black man has no rights that the white man need respect. And for a long time, the very law, the highest court of this country, ruled consistently that African Americans are not people. They're not even people.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So there had to be a progression over a long period of time to just acclimate people to that notion that African Americans are in fact people, that Native Americans are in fact people, that Asian Americans are in fact people. We're now going through a period where people have to be acclimated to the idea that Muslims are in fact people. So as a member of the privileged class, and that is purely on the basis of race and skin color, you derive certain automatic benefits. You don't have to fight for them. They are given to you, and you enjoy the benefits of such a status in our society that members, people who understand themselves to be members of oppressed groups and classes, literally first have to establish their humanity in order to make the case that they're entitled to protection of the law. In fact, that was the whole point of it was all entangled with the Civil War.
Sure.
Blacks, even human beings.
Well, let me ask you this. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Let me ask you this. So you,
quickly, please, because we're running out of time. Go ahead.
You don't think I'm white, do you?
It doesn't matter. I don't know what you are, but I'm making the case that...
Let me say this. But I am African-American. And so, you know, maybe my neighbor perceives or sees it or recognizes that they are of an oppressed class, sure. But this doesn't work. It isn't so much philosophical to say that's why the planet melts. It actually drives an unrestricted liberalizing of resources, including labor. And so, for example, the thing is,
what I'm trying to show you is the conundrum here. Essentially, your argument, your legal argument, is framed within the theory of reverse discrimination. And you have to understand how puzzled that could be if you are, in fact, African American, that you're making the case in a court of law that you intend to challenge statutes that were designed to give some kind of parity to people of an oppressed class. Now, that would mean that the people of that oppressed class will first have to recognize and persuade the court they are members of an oppressed class. You didn't do that. You made the exact opposite. You made a reverse discrimination claim that you are being discriminated against. You understand? You appreciate the conundrum here?
And see, you know, I focus with everybody.
We have to go, I'm afraid. But it strikes me as being interesting that you were essentially making the argument that you are not a member of the oppressed class, and this is, but you are using the reverse discrimination claim in your case. But I thank you so much for calling, and it's a really interesting philosophical conundrum that you posed for us today. Thank you so much for that, for sharing. And that brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You want to stay tuned for that. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.